relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story. I love it when my team does the silent finger countdown. I feel like I'm in a movie studio. Welcome, guys. I'm Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Donald J. Trump, host of America First and the podcast, The Battle for 1600. If you're not aware, if you haven't seen me blasting it out on social media this weekend, after years of plotting, of conniving, I start my TV show, Newsmax. It's called The Gorka Reality Check, 7 p.m. Eastern with a re-air at 10 p.m. Check it out on Newsmax. But it's not about me. It's about our guests. And let me say, I had them recently on this show. They're one of... I'm a podcast hound. I grew up listening to talk radio in the UK. I love the medium. And I recently had two of the best... One of my favorite podcasts is Trigonometry with a double G. And I told the guys, I DM'd them, and we got their I got their cell numbers. Hey, guys, it's Konstantin Kiss and Francis Foster. You had a guy on your show with a cool afro who is probably the best interview you've ever... You've had Jordan Peterson, you've had Nigel Farage, but the guy that impressed me the most is Calvin Robinson. And he's such a cool dude that he responded to my DMs, and he's on the show right now. Calvin Robinson, welcome.
Sebastian, that is the nicest, kindest introduction I've ever had. Thank you very much.
Well, look, I absolutely meant it, because I didn't know you from a hole in the ground. I think I'd seen your pictures somewhere, or maybe... No, I'd seen you on social media, so let me correct. I'd seen you on social media, maybe your face on another podcast, but I'd never watched an hour-long interview, because I think it's like an hour and 7 minutes with the guys.
We really went for it.
Oh, you went for it. And I was blown away. And I wasn't sure, is this like, they're stand-up comics who've had enough with political correctness. That's why their podcast is called Trigonometry, to trigger people. And I for the first few minutes, I thought, is he another one of their comedian buddies? Is this a wind-up? Is this candid camera? What's going on? There's a guy who looks black. Turns out he's got a black dad, white mom, who's saying the most inflammatory, from the point of view of political correctness, most inflammatory things, and making me feel good in what he's saying about patriotism, what it means to be British, the good things about Western culture. And then I realized, no, this isn't a wind-up. This isn't a joke. He means it. So first things first, let me do the trigonometry thing. For those, because we're in the UK... We've got 3 million listeners on the radio show, almost 2 million followers on social media. So I'd like to introduce you to everybody who's going to catch this or see it on social media. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up in the Midlands, your family background and then your professional career. And then we're going to dive into the meat of the issues.
Sure. Okay. So... I grew up in the Midlands, as you mentioned, a small miners town called Mansfield. Not many people have heard of it. It's the kind of place where everyone knows everyone. And my family were, well, my dad's side of the family were one of the first black families in the town. So, you know, I'm able to have this discussion around race in this country from a position of experience, because people will often say, oh, you don't know about racism. What do you know about racism? And I experienced real racism growing up. Trust me when I say that.
But if I can interrupt. You do differentiate between racism and discrimination, correct?
Well, I think that we need to get back to the true word of what racism actually is, and that is discrimination or prejudice against someone based on the color of their skin. And people these days throw it around to say it's some kind of battle between white people and black people, or power and privilege and oppression. It's none of those things, and that's all nonsense that they use to try and win their argument without actually having any facts or evidence to back it up. But, you know, half my family is white, half my family is black, and both sides have experienced racism. Therefore, I can say categorically that anyone can experience racism and anyone can be a victim of racism.
So this is massively important, and I want to drill into this a bit later. So what you just said, so for people who missed it, that the black half of your family experienced racism. You experienced racism as a kid. Yeah. And then your white half of your family experienced racism, Calvin?
Absolutely. And I still experience racism quite often because I'm now in the public sphere over here in the UK. And more often than not, I experience it from black people and other ethnic minorities. Therefore, the evidence is out there that anyone can be racist and anyone can experience racism. I can't say that enough because I'm fed up with this idea that racism is somehow a battle between white people and black people, because it's completely untrue. And the moment we say that, we undermine what's actually going on around the Western world at the moment, and the self-hatred and all of the nonsense that's happening in America and in Great Britain. But I grew up in this small miners town, and people around me, people up there, had a very small C conservative mentality, which I very much model. And people, find it surprising because I live in London, which, as you know, is very metropolitan liberal elite. So it is that woke bubble of everyone trying to out virtue signal each other. But when you go to the rest of the country, you experience normal folk with normal opinions. They don't talk like people in London. They don't have these ideas of 99 plus genders and racism being about oppression and victimhood and all of that rubbish. So when I talk, people, like you mentioned, it's inflammatory, but it's not. It's just normal, everyday opinions from normal British people. And that's why I talk so often, because I want to level up the playing field and make people aware that actually not everyone has this ridiculous idea of what's going on in the country. Not everyone is a social justice warrior. Most people aren't. Most people are small C conservative, believing in British values, Christian values, Western values, and they are important. We need to hold on to them for our dear lives.
He was a teacher, and in the hour-long interview that caught my eye, he used I don't know if it's a neologism, but it was a new word to me. There are extroverts, and he said that he's been labeled a controvert. I love that. If talking the truth gets you to be a controvert, sign me up. So let's talk about my experience, because I left the UK in 1993, long time ago. Been back a few times, but not many. And I grew up in West London, and let me tell you my experience, and you tell me what's changed. I grew up in a part of London that was, it was more multi-ethnic than I could describe anywhere else in America. My best mates at school were Indian, Pakistani. There was one guy in a school of about 600 kids, one guy who could really demonstrate that he was English, okay? Everybody else had some kind of mixture, Italian, Polish, you name it. The bus driver was Jamaican with a thick Jamaican accent. And as far as I was concerned, he was as British as my best mate whose dad spoke with a thick Polish accent. We were rough with each other, the language, physically, what have you. But race wasn't an issue inside that part of West London. Are things better or worse since my experience, Calvin?
A bit of both. So I think we did get to a point where, and you use the term multi-ethnic, and I like that because that's what we should be promoting, multi-ethnicity. But we've actually gone the other way now, and we're pushing more multiculturalism. And I think that's a problem, because it gets to the point where you're adopting so many cultures that you're diluting your own culture, especially when we have an obsession with inclusivity, we do it in the UK at least, that we want everyone to feel welcome, as we should, but to the point that we are no longer promoting British values. We're no longer talking about what makes this country special through fear of offending people from other cultures. And I think that's too far the other way. When we welcome people into our country, we should welcome them to be a part of it and included, speaking the language, embracing the culture. And that's not racist or xenophobic to think that. Most normal people would think that. But again, the more metropolitan liberal elite have been pushing this agenda and diluted Britishness. So now when you come to London, now when you go to these inner city schools, you see that English people are in the minority, at least in London and areas like it. But you're not allowed you're not allowed to promote British values. In fact, the teaching standards over here say you mustn't undermine British values. They don't say anything about promoting them. And
what happens to somebody who says, you know, I want to spend the next 40 minutes in class talking about Churchill, who is a great leader, or I want to talk about the good aspects of the British Empire, not the negative ones, not what happened in Malaya, but the good things that happened in the Indian subcontinent. What would happen to you if you were still a teacher, Calvin, and said, okay, the next period, the next class is going to be about the good stuff of the British identity?
So first and foremost, the militant teachers' unions would be rabid against you. They'd launch a campaign. They'd have people out protesting. They'd call you a racist, a xenophobe, a nationalist, and all these things, and try and paint you as an evil guy for just, you know, promoting normal things. Like just having a flag up. I know that's a normal thing in America, but just having our country's flag, the Union flag, in a British school would be considered extreme. Singing the national anthem would be considered extreme at this point. That's how far we've gone. It's absolutely ridiculous. And I know one school that is doing all of these things and doing it really well, but kept it undercover until it became successful. And even they had trouble promoting it. But the problem is, most schools wouldn't try it, because most teachers, in this country at least, are left-leaning. 80 to 90% of teachers and academics voted for left-wing-leaning parties in the last election. And they are indoctrinating our young people towards their left-wing mentality. And that's why we have such a problem with the younger generations joining these riots and cults and Extinction Rebellion and Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and all of these horrible, horrible schemes and programs that are going on, because young people are being told that our country is bad and that they are bad if they're white, and that if they're not white, they're being oppressed. And it's just a constant stream of negativity from the left.
But it's worse than that, isn't it? I spent the last 20 years in counterterrorism academically and working with the US military. And I look at the case, I remember the case of the 7/7 bombers in London. And you mentioned a word in your interview, belonging. And when you see these Bangladeshi immigrants who want to integrate the parents' generation, and you see the kids who are being told, well, you shouldn't integrate because England is bad, imperial history, so forth, and there's this whole of identity, there's this desire to belong, but they're confused because their parents want to integrate, but they're being told in school that it's a bad country. And then they're ripe for the picking by jihadi recruiters and what have you. So there seems this isn't just a question of the white London entitled environmentalists and BLM protesters. Isn't it a far more serious issue as well, Calvin?
It is much more insidious, and it is, I think it's the neo-Marxists. Yeah. I think at the core of all of these groups that I just mentioned, and the ones that you talked about, there is neo-Marxism. They want to destroy the Western way of life and rebuild it in their own utopian image, which we know doesn't work. We know communism is dangerous. We know socialism is dangerous, but that's what they want. They're anti-capitalist, they're anti-family, and they're anti-Western, and we must fight back on every opportunity, because for too long we've sat back and let them get on with it, thinking, well, you know, they've got their own ideas, let's let them. But no, because it's come to a point now where they're destroying our way of life.
Here, we're facing very similar issues in the US, and we've identified a locus of where these ideas come from. And a lot of it can be identified as the teacher training colleges. That's where the wokeness was incubated. Those were the institutions captured by the new left in the 80s and the late 70s. What's happening in the UK? Where's the genesis of this self-hatred? Have you identified as a former teacher? Is it the same, or are there other centers of gravity?
I'm so glad to be talking to you, because you're really on the money with this stuff. It's amazing. We're so far behind in the UK. So I'm looking to do a research piece with a think tank that I work with, actually, on this very issue, to look at the
teacher
training. Name
it. Give it some exposure. Who's doing work on this?
Policy Exchange. We're looking into this because the teachers' training institutions are, I remember from my personal anecdotal experience, they are where the hotbed of this comes from. This is where all the horrible ideas, the so-called progressive nature of teaching has been pushed. And this is why we have so much left-wing indoctrination in our schools. I'm going to look into this personally and find out what's going on in these institutions, and hopefully make some recommendations for the government to look into this and find out what's going on. Because, you know, I remember it starts out with, well, young people are the leaders in their own education, and we're there to facilitate their learning. And if they're throwing a chair at a teacher, it's because they're trying to express an emotion. And they start off with all this really fluffy mentality, trying to get you away from the idea of authoritarianism. And in a classroom, actually, I, as a teacher, I'm the subject matter expert. I am the expert in that room.
What a radical, hate-filled idea that the teacher knows something that should be imparted to the students.
But it's my job to do that, to impart knowledge. And they're trying to push us away from that and to get us to teach these fluffy ideas so that the kids who don't know what they don't know are leading their own learning. And then they come out of this with ideas of, you know, Trump bad, Orange Man bad, and Boris Johnson, the English Trump. But they don't know, you know, who Shakespeare was or who Mozart was, because these dead white men are no longer important because we've decolonized the curriculum.
For those who missed it, and I'm so glad to hear that on the other side of the pond, Calvin's going to be researching this. We had an hour with Professor James Lindsay, the author of Cynical Theories. Guys, go to our YouTube channel, America First, Sebastian Gorka. Go to our Rumble backup channel, rumble.com/SebGorka, SebGorka. Watch that out. He is here in the U.S., along with Chris Rufo. They are the preeminent experts speaking the truth about these neo-Marxist, new left, insidious concepts that have captured our schools, our colleges, and the media. For the purposes of this discussion, because I know you covered this before, let's talk about this thing, CRT, critical race theory. As a mixed race teacher, as was in the UK, what is the message of critical race theory, Calvin Robinson?
Fantastic people you just mentioned, by the way. And I think James Lindsay's really on the money with this stuff from an academic perspective. But I'm just talking about it from what I see on the ground. And for me, critical race theory is this idea that white people are naturally oppressors and black and ethnic minority people are naturally victims based on the color of their skin. And it's this idea that white privilege means that being white, your skin color will not have affected your chances in life and or given you an advantage, whereas if you are black or ethnic minority, your skin color will have given you a natural disadvantage and you will have hurdles to overcome. And it sounds very well meaning, it sounds pretty good sometimes when people on the left are talking about it, but what's actually happening is it's a self-perpetuating myth of white superiority. And what these people are doing is telling our young people that, you know, as a brown person, you are going to have a harder life. This country is set up against you, it's systemically racist, you're going to have extra hurdles and barriers to overcome, you won't achieve as well as your white neighbors, your white colleagues and peers, and telling the white person that actually you are bad naturally, just given by the color of your skin, you are a bad person, you are racist, whether it's overtly or covertly or institutionally or systemically or whatever. You know, racism is, in their words, is no longer just prejudice, it is now an undercover, it's so covert that we can't see it. And they're pushing these narratives, and kids are starting to believe it. And if you're told often enough as a young person that you won't achieve, of course you won't make anything of yourself. And then when they don't make anything of themselves, they blame this institutional racism, they blame this systemic racism, and it's a self-perpetuating cycle of victimhood. And people are getting stuck on it, stuck in that dependency on the state, which is what the left want, because this is where the left get their votes from, whether it's the Democrat Party in America or the Labour Party in the UK. They, you know, Joe Biden said, if you don't vote Democrat, you ain't black. And over here, we've had Corbyn say that we will unlock the potential of the ethnic minorities. It's patronizing, if not condescending, this idea that the left are the only ones that will support you if your skin is brown. Well, actually, my skin is brown, but I don't need their support. All I want is equal opportunities, and that's what the right provide.
So we couldn't have timed this discussion better just moments before we started this broadcast here in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, which is the federal body that is meant to fight things like, Ebola or the Chinese virus, what have you, have declared under the Biden administration that racism is a serious public health issue. Okay? We have 25% of the youth in America, according to the CDC last June, contemplated suicide because of the lockdown. And we have CRT driving policy at the very top. You mentioned something, Calvin. I just want to dig a little bit deeper. As somebody who looks black, I know you're mixed race, but let's play the identity politics game. What is the long term? If you say for at least two generations to black kids, to minority kids, whatever it is, Pakistanis, what have you, that you are always going to be oppressed, it's not just an eventual reliance upon the big state to provide you with whatever, unearned excess. What is, as a teacher, you must have seen this, what is the mental damage on a child in terms of self-esteem, self-imposed psychological limitations, if you are told the system is bent and you're never going to win?
I mean, it's catastrophic, but I'm not a mental health expert, so I don't want to talk about
it too much. But in your experience,
what I can say from my experience is what I've seen and the evidence that I have. So we can talk about when Caribbean people first came over to the United Kingdom, like my dad's father. We can see that generation of immigrants were really hardworking. Their exam results were fantastic, magnificent. They did really well because they had this work ethic and this belief in social mobility and to achieve in society, to achieve success.
And a desire to integrate.
And study hard and to integrate. But the problem is, these families have integrated, and black Caribbean families are now at the bottom of the league tables, along with white British families. And I'm talking about young people in schools here. And the reason that they've gone from up here down to the bottom is because of this mentality. And if we measure black Caribbean kids against black African kids who are newer immigrants, we can see that the evidence is right in front of our eyes that black African kids are succeeding all throughout school, throughout primary school, secondary school, or high school, as you call it, into higher education, into our universities. They're twice as likely to get into university than white British kids and black Caribbean kids. And this is because they still have that work ethic, that family structure of two parents in a stable family. They still believe in social mobility and education being the route out of poverty, whereas black Caribbean families and white British families no longer have that. And so we can see the direct evidence, the results are right in front of our eyes, the numbers are right there, but they don't want us to see that, which is why they'll not. This is why the left won't discuss the difference between ethnic minority groups, and they lump us all into one. Call us over here, it's BAME. I know you've got BIPOC over there, but they lump us all into one homogenous group so that the results are skewed in their favor.
What you just described, and when you said this before in the other interview, it really stung me, is a tragic tale, a truly tragic tale, that two generations ago, the newest immigrants totally integrated and were successful, but their children and grandchildren, because of a theory, because of an ideology, have become a generation that is tinged and defined by failure as more recent immigrants who may have the same pigmentation but are from a completely different part of the world are outstripping them in the schools because they don't have that victim mentality. It is truly tragic and really the most dangerous part of all of this multiculturalism vice multi-ethnicity. On this issue, can you expand upon the idea of white racism, meaning it's okay to be racist against those who are white today? How is that possible?
It's all part of the same problem. We had a report come out, government-backed report, an independent government-backed report, came out last week that showed there are still many elements of racial disparities in our country, but really went down to the core of these issues and found that, you know, most racial disparities have more underlying problems, and it's not evidence of racism in and of itself. So, for example, black mothers tend to have higher mortality rates during childbirth than white mothers. And we've always assumed that these things are proof of institutional racism because people want to automatically jump to racism when they see a racial disparity. But when you get deep down into the core of it, you find there are many other issues at play, such as geography, other health implications, wealth, family background, all of these things come into racial disparities. So it's not to suggest that, I mean, even you, I always say, does this pass the common sense test? Do you genuinely think that midwives are treating black mothers differently to white mothers? And the answer is often, of course, not. But then we actually look at the stats and found that, well, most midwives in London are ethnic minorities anyway. So
right.
it's not even a case of
racism. So the idea that they would be punishing their own ethnicity is, of course,
exactly,
so absurd.
But why I'm talking about this is because this report has come out, found all these racial disparities, found lots of reasons behind them. It's evidence-based, lots of research, and the left are coming at it because it has found no evidence of institutional racism. So the left don't actually want to address the issues. They don't want to solve inequalities in our society. They want to battle on this issue of institutional racism, which is the idea that the white man at the top of the ladder in the power structures is naturally racist. And that makes it fair game. And not just for white people, it makes it fair game to attack anyone who doesn't believe in their system. So me, as a mixed race person, I get racially abused by the hard left all of the time, as do many white men, particularly straight white men, or, you know, at the bottom of this intersectionality ladder. And it's, they're fair game because we're not part of their approved narrative, of their structure that they believe in. And it is a belief structure.
So it's okay, just to be clear, it's okay to be racist against people who are white, or it's okay to be racist against somebody like you who doesn't subscribe to the narrative of systemic racism. That's how it's okay to be racist today. Yeah. Let's be conscientious in our analysis here. And this is an important question I wanted to ask you in terms of critical race theory. What is the putative end state? What can you, if you really believe in critical race theory, what is the logical end state? Because if you say white people are racist, if you say it's endemic, if the patriarchy, the cisgender, heterosexual white patriarchy is genetically racist, then logically, Calvin, the end state has to be a reverse oppression. The minorities must suppress the whites. Isn't that really the only logical outcome?
It is, entirely. And Douglas Murray talks a lot about this really well. It's this overcorrection. So we see the same in feminism. You know, at this point, fourth wave feminism isn't about equality anymore because women have equality. It's now about special treatment and extra treatment. It's not about women being the same as men. It's about women being better than men. And we have this with critical race theory. It's not, we have equality under the law in the UK and the US. And at this point, it's no longer about black people or ethnic minorities being the same as white people. It's about white people being less than black people and ethnic minorities and treated less well and having less special treatment under the law. And that is problematic for a whole host of reasons, because it is essentially racist. That is the problem. Critical race theory wraps itself up as an anti-racist ideology, but at its core, it is racist.
All right, I'm just writing down a tweet I have to send out later. Critical race theory is racist, quoting Calvin Robinson. Follow him right now, at Calvin Robinson on Twitter. Fabulous, fabulous interview. Calvin, you said something, you said previously, it's okay to be proud to be British. How many people say that in the UK today, openly?
Unfortunately, not many. We've gotten to the point where if you put our union flag out on your porch, you'll be classed as a racist. And we have two flags. We've obviously got the flag of England, the St. George's Cross. If you put that one out, even worse, you'll be cast aside. You'll be stigmatized in society. It's really, really gotten to that level. It's beyond belief. And the left, you know, the Labour Party over here, who used to be the working class party, they used to be the party of, you know, miners. I'm from a miners town. And they are the ones looking down their nose, sneering at proud Brits, sneering at patriots for having some pride in their country. And I think it's disgraceful because, again, it's divisive. Being British is the thing that unites us. It doesn't matter if you're black, white, Asian. It doesn't matter if you're Christian or Muslim. It doesn't matter. All of these things peel away the moment we say the one thing that unites us is that we're British. And that's why they're so keen on dividing us down to our subgroups and splitting us apart. Because, again, it comes down to a form of control. They can control us when we're divided. Divide and conquer is the oldest method in the book, you know, the art of war. And that's why they're so keen on it.
Thank you for mentioning one of my favorite books, Sun Tzu's Art of War. If you haven't read it, it takes about 3 hours. Do it, guys. Get it this weekend and read it. Let's talk about moving forward. What has to be done, as a certain revolutionary called Lenin said, what is to be done? You mentioned faith and family as the bulwark, as the antidote. I grew up in West London as a cradle Catholic. I've been following the state of the Church of England. I think it's moribund at this time. It used to be a social club. I think it's no longer even a social club. What do you see as the way ahead, the way out of this? Is this just a cycle? Will there be an organic response? We saw Brexit. And let me combine two questions here. So what is to be done and who's doing it? And then you often use, and at the beginning you used this before we went live, you said, I'm not a member of the Conservative Party, but I'm a small C conservative. Do these labels mean anything anymore? Does Conservative, does Labour, does Tory, has the taxonomy fundamentally broken down? Let's start with that one.
Okay, so I think, yes, it has broken down in every sense. Conservatives are no longer interested in conserving. You know, a Conservative should look to protect our past, not for the present, but for future generations. The Labour Party don't care about the working class anymore, which is where the word Labour came from. The Liberal Democrats are neither liberal nor democratic. You know, they wanted to cancel Brexit, which is the largest democratic mandate we've ever had in this country. So these labels don't mean anything. I call myself a small C conservative, and I think that's what most people in this country are, as in we believe in family values, Christian values, and we believe in protecting our heritage and our culture. And those aren't things to be ashamed of. But I don't know what the word liberal means anymore. That's one I've given up using, because you've got classical liberal. It means something different in America than it does over here. It used to mean a protection of freedoms, and now it seems to mean wokeness. So I can't even subscribe to that. But I call myself high church, high Tory as well. You know, the old fashioned Tories were conservative, and in the high church, we, you know, Catholicity, we had Christian values at the core of everything we do. So to bring that around to the first part of your question, where do we go? How do we solve this? And what's the way forward? We have to shine as a light. We have to be strong Christians offering people an alternative, because people are genuinely lost. People are looking for this sense of belonging. That's why they're clinging on to all of these horrible groups like Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion. And if we offer them a positive alternative with true universal morality, not this horrible morality of a critical race theory where anyone's fair game as long as they're not us. You know, we want to believe in truth and good versus evil rather than whatever the left is making up. And we have to lead by example. We have to lead good Christian lives. We have to talk with people we disagree with, talk with them well. We have to forgive people, get rid of cancel culture. If people say or do things on social media that we don't agree with, that's fine. You know, supporting their freedom of speech. We don't have to listen. We have our freedom to not listen, but we have to absolutely encourage people to speak up and not be no-platformed and not cancel people just because we don't agree with what they say. And if they do say something bad, we have to forgive them and move on and not go after their livelihoods, not go after their jobs, not go after their families. We have to show the left how it's done, because they have lost their sense of compassion. They've lost their ethics. We still have ours, but we're the quiet, we are the silent majority. So it's time for us to stand up and stop being silent.
That's easy for you to say, because you're a brave man, Calvin Robinson. What would you say to those who watch this interview, hear the podcast, and who, for all, you know, completely empirically measurable reasons, truly feel intimidated? Share with us, if you will, why you decided to be a public figure on these issues. And what do you say to those who just say, you know, I'm just like, you know, my parents who escaped communism were surrounded by people who said, I'm just going to keep my head down so nobody notices me. What's your message to them, Calvin?
So the reason I do what I do is because I've realized, you know, when I got involved in politics, it was because I wanted to shine a light on the left-wing indoctrination in our schools. And I thought, I'll never talk about race because I don't want to be pigeonholed. And I saw how the left pigeonholed people of color into their categories, into their boxes, and I don't want that. But the reason I do speak about race so much is because I've realized that white people are no longer able to. I am allowed to say things. I can get away with saying things that the straight white male can no longer say in this country and in America. And I think that's problematic. So I'm going to keep saying things until it's normalized again and desensitized, and we can actually have a conversation, all of us, on an equal platform, no matter what our skin color is.
But what was it? Was it a sense of censorship or a sense of injustice? Can you identify, can you label the motivational spirit there?
It's absolutely injustice. Yeah. And we all see this injustice. And that comes to the second part of your question, in that what should people do? It's easy for me to say, you know, I'm used to, I'm a public platform now. I'm used to getting my head cut off and whatever. But we have to carry the weight of the cross, and that's not easy for anyone. That's what we're called to do as Christians. We have to say enough is enough, and we have to stand up for our principles and for our Christian values, because that's what God asked us to do. That's why Christ was among us. That's what he taught us. And no, you're right, it's not easy. And, you know, but the problem is they can't cancel all of us. So if we all stand up together, we'll be fine.
All right, I'm writing that. That's a doozy. That's a keeper. I'm writing that one down. They can't cancel all of us. I want to just recognize you, Calvin. God bless you. I don't wear my faith on my sleeve. Now and again, it'll creep out on the radio. We just had Holy Week, and I'll go off on a monologue or something when I'm inspired. But we don't get people who use the phrase, that's the message of the cross, and who translate the utter quintessence, the core of our civilization into truly that sentence, that whatever it is, whether it's the rights of the unborn, whether it's censorship, whether it's any form of injustice, picking up that mantle publicly is a form of picking up the cross upon which our Savior died for us. So right now, we don't rehearse any of this. We don't have any talking points. I didn't send you questions. You didn't tell me stuff that I wasn't allowed to ask you about. I'm just going to say, God bless you, Calvin, for saying what you said, because I think at the end of the day, everything we've discussed goes back to two things. It is rebuilding the family, that the black community have been crushed in respect to how the import of the family has been undermined by politics, by government, for well-intentioned purposes, I get it, but not when it comes to BLM. And then faith, that we've lost our way and our cultural heritage. So thank you for doing that. Let's end on a note from our teacher, Calvin Robinson. Give us some homework for those who want to be better informed, better educated. Where should they start? What should they read in terms of prepping for the exam that is the future of our civilization?
Oh, okay. I think read Rod Dreher's The Benedict Option. That will get us ready to live a Christian lifestyle amongst an increasingly secular world.
Although his argument that you have to sequester yourself, are you happy with that? Because I find that a little problematic.
I don't agree with everything he says, but I do think he points us in the right direction, okay, at least. Anything by Douglas Murray, he articulates these arguments so well.
The Madness of Crowds, his last book.
Oh, yes. Right. Fantastic. Right. I think he updated it for critical race theory as well, or Black Lives Matter, rather. Same thing. Thomas Sowell,
yes.
Absolutely fantastic on all of these issues. And if we want to go further back, Booker T. Washington saw all of this coming. I think those are my recommendations.
Fabulous. Booker T. Washington, the incredible Thomas Sowell. Yes, Douglas Murray, I think it was The Death of Europe, then The Madness of Crowds. And then the first one was... Oh, and I mentioned Cynical Theories. Check out Cynical Theories by James Lindsay. And for me, if I may be so bold to abuse the chair, the book, I don't read autobiographies, but the book that changed my life, two books really, is The Hillbilly Elegy. If you want to understand the American struggle, how the working class was betrayed by both the Democrats and the Republicans, that story of J.D. Vance and his family is a stunning story. You can read it in a weekend, and it's a true story. And the book that really changed my understanding of all of this, The Origins of the New Left, if you read only one thing in the next month, dear friends, it's chapter 6 of Andrew Breitbart's Righteous Indignation. Andrew Breitbart, who had one mission, crush the bullies, was, as he called himself, a mindless, drunk student at Tulane University who witnessed the abuse of a black conservative called Clarence Thomas, and then he wanted to investigate how they could do that to that man who wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. Read Righteous Indignation Chapter 6, which inspired me to write my book, The War for America's Soul. So that's enough homework. That's enough homework, everybody. In the meantime, follow this man at Calvin, with a C, Calvin Robinson on Twitter. God bless you. Keep doing what you do, Calvin. And thank you for joining us today.
Same to you. Keep fighting the good fight. God bless.
God bless. And I hope to see you sometime over this side of the pond.
That'll be fantastic. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.